What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
So let me ask you this. What did you think? Did you like Saul Goodman right when we first meet him here?
I did. And he quickly became one of my favorite characters just because of the comic relief.
Yeah. I think that's the thing about this character, right? I mean, I liked Bob Odenkirk. I liked Mr. Show, which was, you know, around for a while and before he shows up here. It seemed like an interesting choice because of that. You know what I mean? He was a comedy guy, and while Breaking Bad is funny, it wasn't really a comedy show. You know what I mean? And I thought he was amusing, but I mean, I think if I like compare it to the introduction of Gus, maybe, you know, like I found Gus a lot more intriguing from the beginning. And so I guess the next question then is, whenever Breaking Bad finished and the rumors were going around that they were going to make a Saul show, how excited for that were you?
Personally, very excited. So as I just noted, Saul was one of my favorite characters on Breaking Bad. So I was really excited. I was a little concerned. I wasn't sure how they would be able to pull it off. And of course, you know, they had discussed doing like a half an hour comedy type show before, mm-hmm. you know, they settled on doing an hour long drama, which, you know, I'm glad they did. but yeah, I was actually really excited to revisit this world. I was really, really pumped.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I remember pretty distinctly whenever I first watched, you know, Better Call Saul when it first came out. And I was definitely excited to see what they did, but I wasn't excited about the choice of making a purely Saul show. I think that was a pretty common idea at the time. I think you were kind of an outlier in being super excited about it. I think there was a lot of Saul fans. I mean, like, he was a great character. But I think what's really interesting is because, you know, we just finished Saul and we know a lot more about it. And so we were excited when we're getting ready to do this episode, you know, to reintroduce him into the Breaking Bad timeline and see how everything has been recontextualized based on what we know. We have a lot more information about Jimmy McGill. And, you know, that, I guess that's sort of where I was going with all this, is that it's a crazy surprise how interesting a character this is, all things considered, for me, from my point of view, you know, that like how they really, because I mean, I really like Jimmy McGill, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Agreed completely there. And so one of the things I really appreciate about Better Call Saul as a series is that they didn't just give us all this backstory on this one character who was a clown, you know, and I was amused by him. I thought he was a great character, very funny. And I was really excited for the show, but I was also really excited to see the backstory of the other characters. So I think what they were able to do with Mike and with Gus is amazing. So you get so much in Better Call Saul that really recontextualizes a lot of Breaking Bad and really deepened my love for these characters. Like, I liked Mike, I liked Saul, I liked Gus in Breaking Bad, but I love all three of those characters in Better Call Saul. And when Better Call Saul first started, like the first couple episodes, like bringing back Tuco and everything, I was like, oh, this is kind of cheesy, you know, like using some of like very similar dialogue and acting from Raymond Cruz, for example. And I was like, I don't know about this. So, but then I think with the introduction of his brother, of Charles, and certainly with him, I was like, okay, they really have something new here to tell. And I got hooked really, really early with Saul. I was all in. And you said I'm an outlier. Definitely, 100%. I'm an outlier in like pretty much everything. But you know, I love Saul. And dare I even say it, that I like Saul better than Breaking Bad?
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about this a little bit more when we get into things, because we did a little bit of watching both for this, but. You keep bringing up this guy, Mike. Who's Mike? What are you talking about? I've only seen Breaking Bad through episode 208. I don't know who this Mike guy you're talking about is.
Well, he gets referenced in 208 as the PI who does, research on Walt. So, and we'll meet him later this season.
Why don't you just kill Badger? I mean, follow me, guys, but mosquitoes buzzing around you bite you on the ass. You don't go gunning for the mosquito's attorney. You go grab a fly swatter, I mean, so to speak. I mean, all due respect, but do I have to spell this out for you? We're not killing Badger, yo! Then you got real problems, okay? Because the DEA is going to come down on your boy like a proverbial ton of bricks.
Hey, this is Growth Decay Transformation, a Breaking Bad rewatch podcast. I'm Pete.
And I'm Courtney.
And today we're talking about 208, Better Call Saul, which is introducing a new character that we have talked a lot about in different shows and different videos. We finally made it. We finally made it to the introduction of Jamie McGill, although we won't talk about him here by that name. So how about we get a synopsis of what happened?
Yeah, so this episode starts with a oneer where it's one long take, although they did have to figure out how to add in some edits of it, Badger getting busted. So he's sitting on this this park bench with a Better Call Saul advertisement on it, and he does sell to an undercover cop. We then transition to a classic Better Call Saul commercial, which is being shown on Jesse's new flat screen, which is finally turned on, and the reveal that Jesse and Jane have taken their relationship to the next level. When Jesse suggests that they burn a joint, Jane reveals that she is in recovery. Meanwhile, Marie calls the White House in a panic, so Walt goes over to the house to find Hank holed up in his bed. He's clearly suffering from PTSD, and Marie leaves them to talk alone. Later at Jesse's, Walt questions why they're short, and then we find out that everyone was too scared to tell Jesse that Badger got busted. Hank goes to work, and Gomi tells him the news that they finally busted a blue meth dealer, Badger. They leave to go question him, and at the station, the undercover cop who busted Badger is trying to persuade him to tell him who he works for when Saul Goodman enters the room and gives Badger instructions on how to pay him. Outside of a strip mall, Walt and Jesse debate who will go inside to talk to Saul. Walt loses the coin toss. He always loses the coin toss. And he introduces himself to Saul as Badger's uncle, Mr. Mayhew.
I was just going to say, you know, we'll get into this, I'm sure, but thinking about if it had gone the other way is kind of a fun thought experiment, right? If Jesse had gone in and talked to Saul the first time, it would have been a lot different. I wonder how that would have went down. I mean, you think he would have trusted Jesse more just because he does, as Walt pointed out, look like one of his regular clients?
Maybe. You mean in terms of like accepting the bribe from him?
Yeah.
Could be. I mean, we know it's not the first time that Jesse's ever been to that office, because if you watch 611 Better Call Saul Breaking Bad, you'll know that he goes there with Emilio and he stands outside. He doesn't actually go inside. It is an interesting thought, though. Okay, getting back to this, where was I? Okay, so when Walt learns that the DEA is investigating, he offers Saul a $10,000 bribe, which Saul refuses. Later that night, as Saul is leaving his office, and, you know, he offers to follow Francesca home, Walt and Jesse kidnap him and then drive him out to the desert and kneel him in front of an open grave. Saul agrees to take the bribe and comes up with the plan to have a repeat offender, James Kilkelly, also known as Jimmy In-N-Out, pose as Heisenberg. The DEA has Badger meet with Heisenberg on the same park bench he got busted on as they wait in the cars. Jesse and Walt wait down the street in the Aztec. A bald man comes over and sits next to Badger, and Badger's trying to make the deal with this guy, not realizing it's the wrong guy. Finally, Jimmy shows up, but he sits on the wrong bench. So Walt forces Jesse to get out of the car to tell Badger as he distracts Hank. It works, and Badger moves over to the other bench, and the deal goes down as planned. Back at Jesse's, Jane comes over and they try out his new mattress. And then the episode closes with Walt in his classroom after school grading papers when Saul comes in and explains that it was way too easy for his PI to find him and makes the case that Walt needs him and his counsel. He says, if you want to make more money and keep the money you make, better call Saul.
Better call Saul.
Yeah. So what did you think about this one, Pete? Either when you first watched it or upon rewatch, what occurred to you?
It's a little bit weird. I can't remember what I thought about the first time, but it's a little bit weird in the way that it's structured to sort of have this roadblock and then solve it. It almost feels like a different show the way that they, you know, it like is set up or whatever. It feels a little bit more episodic than serialized, which it's, you know, they've been you know, moving at a pretty deliberate pace up until this. But I mean, even when you don't know what to make of this new character, Saul Goodman, and how important he'll turn out to be for this whole universe and everything else, you know, this episode does still feel important. While things were bad at home and Walt's making these bad decisions as far as expanding, you know, like that's all really concerning. It did start to feel like in the background they were starting to make some money and that they were making some progress towards securing the cash that he wanted to leave behind for his family. Things were looking like they were on the, I want to say like improving or they were good, but you know, they were trending in the direction of where he wanted to go. Right. And so Badger getting busted, that's this next obstacle that you kind of know is coming or whatever. And it once again, like exposes how incompetent they are. And, you know, Saul is the perfect remedy for that because as much as he kind of comes off like a cartoon character, it does, even by the end of this episode, it becomes apparent that he is pretty good at what he does, you know, and he could be a missing ingredient to this, you know, fledgling operation that they're putting together. He might be the thing that they need to take them to the next level. And, he's funny, so that's, you know, that's a pretty interesting prospect. And like I said, I think it does feel important, even like, you know, not knowing what's going to happen. What do you think? What were your overall impressions?
Well, something you just said about how incompetent Walt and Jesse are is something that I've been thinking a lot about, especially after watching Better Call Saul 6-11 again, and how like they really try to put like create the narrative that Walt could not have become Heisenberg without this guy, right? And of course, that's something that Jimmy in Better Call Saul owns in the finale, that you know, he was an integral part of that whole operation and Walt's success. And it's something, of course, that like, you know, he's a great lawyer. He helps Walt out a lot over the rest of the series. And really pulls his ass out of the fire on multiple occasions, right? So, like, from the, you know, connecting him with, like, everyone in his little black book, like the vacuum cleaner guy, Ed, so on and so forth. But it, you know, I think rewatching it now, this is, like, the part that was most recontextualized for me. Because, like, it's not actually that difficult for me to separate the two shows because I've seen this one first and I'm so familiar with it, right? And, like, I tend to think of them, like, Saul Goodman and Jimmy McGill as somewhat separate characters. But it was different for me this time. And as noted, this episode is one that is kind of near and dear to my heart just because it introduces one of the most important characters and my personal favorite character in the Breaking Bad universe. Although Kim Wexler is...
I was going to say, I didn't see Kim in this episode at all.
I didn't see Kim in this episode, but I couldn't help but think of the end of 609, Fun and Games, and that like really jarring jump cut, you know, from them breaking up to him being this guy that we see in this episode. And it was like tinged with a certain amount of sadness watching it, because like I've always just thought of Saul as like the clown, as the comedic relief, but I it really did carry over for me this time. I was thinking about all of that, the weight of that history and how he actually became Saul Goodman. And not that Kim is what turned him into Saul Goodman, but that was like, you know, the final straw maybe. That's a whole other discussion. But yeah, so watching the birth of this persona, Saul Goodman, and rewatching this, knowing how he got there, definitely made me feel differently about this character.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, you know, watching 6-11, BC, you know, Better Call Saul 6-11, it's pretty, you know, like it's not really that subtle when you know how it ends, right? Like I remember watching, you know, 6/11. I remember we talked about it in a live stream afterwards. And there was a lot of questions when you watched it at first, like, why is he doing what he's doing? What was that telephone call? You know, you knew he was calling to Kim. You know, you didn't see it from her point of view yet, like, which happens in the next episode in Better Call Saul. And so there was a lot of stuff, but like, it's a pretty clear thing, you know, like he breaks bad after he talks to her, you know, after that goes wrong, right?
Yeah.
He goes out and he does these, he goes on to like this next level of scamming, like this really kind of despicable scamming that he does there, you know, drugging people and everything else, right?
Yeah.
It's a direct result of this, whatever this bad feeling he has that he got from this phone call. And so, yeah, like when you watch this episode now, there's a little bit of time in between, but this is what we're seeing, where he's at as a character whenever they meet him is a direct result of what happens in 609, right? Better Call Saul 609 whenever she leaves. And, yeah, that is a much sadder story. You know, than what it seemed like previously.
Yeah, it is. I mean, he really is Frankenstein's monster. 100%. And God, if you haven't seen Better Call Saul, this, you have to check out 611 Breaking Bad. So good. I love everything about that episode. So good.
Yeah,
watching him self-deconstruct, right? And as you noted, Pete, it was the phone call that really tipped him over there. I don't know if I mentioned this when we live streamed after we watched that episode, or if I talked about this in one of the videos that I made, because I made a couple of videos about this one. But it seemed to me like he really wanted to get caught. But that's like another story there. And of course, once we have like the full context of that conversation that those two characters had.
Yeah.
I think maybe subconsciously he did. I don't know.
Yeah. There's a couple other things I think that'll tie in with that. But to bring it back to Breaking Bad, since this is a Breaking Bad rewatch podcast, as an aside, I guess, like, you know, as making videos about Better Call Saul for a few years, this opening of this episode is one that I went back to use for the clip several times, you know. Just because he's sitting on the bench, you know, it's Badger. He's sitting on the bench and the Better Call Saul advertisement's there. And it's a great looking shot. And it's always been one of my favorite. It's like, it's not a very event, like not much happens in this teaser as compared to a lot of them. You know what I mean? As far as like, it, you know, it's pretty linear as based on what comes next in the episode or whatever. But I always liked it. And I never really put two and two together that it was a oneer until, you know, I just rewatched it this time, you know, and I always liked it's sort of a wide shot, you know, where you can see them and you can see everything in that, you know, there's no real close-ups of what's going on there. It always gave it a nice feeling or whatever, but it's a really memorable teaser, I think. And I love how there's this Badger talks himself into getting arrested here, right? You know what I mean? Like the guy, he tells the guy, I smell bacon or whatever, you know, or I so smell bacon. He points out where both vans are. Yeah. He totally has the drop on them. Mm-hmm. But because the cop, you know, kind of outsmarts him and says, okay, I'm leaving then, you know, no big deal. Badger talks himself into getting caught. And I just think that was such a great way to construct the, you know, this whole situation.
Yeah, agreed completely. And something that I picked up on rewatching this, right? So how does the undercover cop actually get Badger to do it? He says, well, I've got it. You know, you have to ask me like if, you know, it's in the Constitution that like a police officer has to tell you.
The American Constitution of America?
Yeah. I mean, so he uses the weight or the credibility of the Constitution to lie to Badger to get him to sell to him. But rewatching this episode, you might have noticed that the Constitution comes up a couple times, right? So that's mm-hmm. of course something that Saul says in his commercials, right? So like, did you know you have rights? The Constitution says you do, right? And Badger mentions it again when he's being interviewed by the undercover cop, whose name is Getz, by the way. So I'll just call him Getz, the guy that looks like he's like in preschool, as Saul jokes. He says, like, what does he say? Badger says, I like guys who don't like abuse the Constitution, you know? Yeah. So like this idea of like, I feel like in a way it's kind of poking fun at like this certain sensibility of like American like ideals about mm-hmm. like you know, what is sacred and stuff like that. And in both cases, both the police officer and Saul are appealing to this value, this idea of the Constitution and the naivete of would be criminals or criminals, right? Mm-hmm. I thought that was really interesting how, like, we had the two different presentations of the Constitution throughout.
And, you know, he likes people who don't. I mean, I guess we'll get back to that at some point. But I do really like the performance there from Badger. He's really hurt that this guy that he thought he was going to hang out with.
Yeah, I thought we were going to hang out.
Yeah, they would do that to him. But, yeah, but he, you know, he says, I like people who don't abuse the Constitution, but then he meets Saul Goodman who makes a living out of abusing the Constitution. Yeah. So just in case exactly. That wasn't, you know, if that wasn't explicit, that that's a great little thing that they have right there.
Don't forget your pants. We'll be back after this short break.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
For Prestige, me and Aaron are still extending our Shogun Afterglow with part 3 of our discussion of the 1980s TV miniseries. Last week absolutely shocked our sensibilities with Lord Toranaga doing the tango. What delights and horrors will await us this week?
Then for Pulp, this Friday join us for our latest prep session for House of the Dragon Season 2 as we take another look at the key differences between the text of Fire and Blood, the on-screen action for Season 1, and what they mean for the characters, story, and setting. Get your Valyrian steel sharpened for the new season.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Fire up the RV. We're back with more growth, decay, transformation.
From there, we go to, as you mentioned, the TV commercial, which will become an ongoing thing throughout the series. We'll see different ones. The idea that Jane is in recovery, you know, this has sort of been, there's been something that was going on with Jane since we first met her. We really couldn't figure out what it was. We knew there was an attraction, something that gave her a connection to Jesse. Now we kind of know where that's at.
She mentions that her dad has busted her many, many times, right?
Right.
And but as you were saying, this was heavily foreshadowed, right? That the mm-hmm. connection or the attraction she had to Jesse was on this shared experience when it comes to family and disappointments.
Yeah, and I thought they did a really good job of setting this up too, because, I mean, we don't know much about her, but like all of the spells that she's going to, you know, that Jesse's going to be bad for her, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of see her know that, you know, like she figures that out too, not just us, right?
Yeah.
But then she's not really ready to make the right choice and just sort of, you know, peace out on him. And, you know, we'll see how that turns out in the coming episodes.
If anything, it makes him more attractive to her. So when he comes back later in the episode and she had let in the movers to drop off his mattress, you know, this was after that whole exchange that morning. I'm assuming it was maybe the day before or the morning where they woke up together the first time they were intimate. And so, yeah, I mean, she definitely makes her own choices here. And then, of course, later, after Combo dies and she goes to walk out of the apartment, that's one of, I mean, it's a huge turning point, of course, for that character. But you can already start to see how that is foreshadowed, those choices that she makes, those bad choices. So the scene I'm talking about that happens later is Jesse's really depressed and he tells her to leave because he wants to get high because he's so depressed. And uh-huh. she's like, come to a meeting with me. And he's like, no, you should just leave. She goes to leave and then she turns around and comes back and the rest is history, so to speak. But I feel like that's all very, very heavily foreshadowed here. And we talked a little bit about this in the last episode about the two different relationships that we were starting to see unfold between Skylar mm-hmm. and Ted and then Jesse and Jane, and how like they're both like you can already see how doomed both of those relationships are going to be. And I feel like this one just like this episode really just adds to that. It's interesting to go back and watch, and you can see like all the little hints along the way, right?
Yeah, I did like the idea that the satellite's finally on. I thought that was a nice way to orient us in the timeline of like how that went down and everything else. And you brought up Skylar there. Not much Skylar at all in this episode. Just a quick...
I was going to say, but what we do get with Skylar, I think, is really interesting, right? So like that one scene where... she's, I guess it's like a Saturday, I'm assuming,
because
casual Saturday, and she's all dressed and she's bringing pasta salad or whatever she has to work, and she's wearing like a low cut dress and he's looking at her up and down, and she says, it's work, Walt, everybody's going to be there, you know, after he remarks that, like, you know, you look nice. And it struck me as very defensive, right? Like mm-hmm. it was she's protesting a little bit too much, so she might be feeling a little bit guilty just by the thoughts that she's having already, the flirtations that she's already been sort of exploring with Ted, you know. And when I rewatched this one, I was watching with my husband, and he had like a different take on this one, and he was like, see, like, you know, Walt really had nothing to worry about. And I was like, I don't know about that, you know, because I don't know, the way like she, you know, kind of covered herself and she was like, oh, everyone's gonna be there, what's the big deal, sort of thing. I don't know. What did you think about that?
Well, I thought that it felt like, yeah, I agree with you that she was a little bit too defensive. It felt like it was setting something up, but we don't see what that is. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's what that's what I thought about what we see from her in this episode. It was kind of just there to remind us that she exists, but the episode really isn't concerned with her too much. I don't know. I mean, I wondered briefly, like, is this something, like, is everyone really going to be there? Is this something different? Like, is, you know, like, is there something like where she's just going in to get the extra money. And then, you know, she's hoping that he'll be there. Like, you know, I mean, I wasn't really clear on what was happening, but it did seem like there was something that she wasn't being upfront about. You just don't know what that is at that point.
Yeah, well, I've got the impression she was telling the truth. Like, it is just a work thing, right? And, I mean, we see, like, later at that really cringy happy birthday that she sings to Ted.
It's one of the most cringy things that happens.
Oh, it's so painful to watch. Like, the secondhand embarrassment. Secondhand embarrassment is next level with that one. But no, I think with this one, it's like, you know, she's obviously put more effort into her appearance. She looks very nice. She looks attractive. She's highlighting her, you know, femininity by wearing a low plunging dress and everything. So she wants to look nice for her boss, right? And I think, you know, that's where that awkwardness comes from, right? And there's like this unspoken thing between both her and Walt.
And we sort of got into it whenever Aaron was on about where Walt thought he was with her at the end of, you know, the situation with the with Gretchen saying that she wasn't going to pay anymore. And I think kind of, you know, he seems like his radar was up a little bit here, but he kind of accepted that this is all just normal because it does. It keeps the focus off of him, right? Like he doesn't have to explain like where he's going for the weekend or whatever, because she's got her own stuff that she's doing now. So it all does feel like it's kind of working in his favor at this point. But, you know, just like anything in this show, whenever it starts to work too good, then something comes up to mess it up for them. And I wanted to talk about a little bit before we get into like the arrest and everything else that happens there and Saul's introduction, but this quick exchange between Hank and Walt, because I thought that is another thing that feels like, I mean, there's a decent amount of Hank in this episode, but like this little interaction here, it feels similar to the one that we have with Jane and Jesse, in that, you know, it's setting the stage for a lot of things that are going to develop between these two characters going forward. Mm-hmm. And you know, they kind of do this thing in where you put Walt in a situation with a character and it almost feels like he might confess, you know what I mean? And you're like, it makes you sort of really pay attention or whatever, even though you know he probably won't or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you know, he says, what does Hank say? He says, you and me, we don't have much of a, what you might call experiential overlap, right?
Yeah.
And then he says, oh, but maybe we do. Or what if I told you we do? And then you think, oh, he's going to tell him that he's a meth cook, you know, like that's the initial reaction, right? And then of course he doesn't do that. But, I thought this scene was really interesting, because you see that Walt is, you know, he's saying this stuff. He's saying that he was scared. He was always, you know, he lived his life a certain way. He couldn't sleep at night. He was worried about things that might happen. But then ever since he had his diagnosis, he sleeps fine, you know. And I think all of that's somewhat true, right? Like,
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's somewhat true, but I think that it's also the fact that he has started doing this other thing that empowers him, that makes him feel like he's a different person. And I'm not sure if the character knows how that works or whatever, or what's working there. But like, I really like this interaction between him and Hank, because he's giving good advice. You know, it's similar to where you see a lot of other characters do that for him at times. You know, like they tell him the thing he needs to hear and he's just like, no, screw that. I'm going to do what I want to do. Right. And, you know, he kind of does that with Hank here. And we see how Hank, has a character is incapable of kind of doing the things that might make sense for him. And I thought that Dean Norris does a really, really good job of cycling through that whenever these two characters are talking, because, I mean, obviously we know that, you know, Bryan Cranston is really good at these kinds of scenes where you can kind of follow his character's thinking through, like the way he looks as he's, you know, processing information. I think you see a really good example of that with Hank here.
Yeah, agreed. It is a really interesting conversation for a couple of reasons, most of which you just noted there. But just something that I think is really highlighted in that scene between these two characters is that moment of candor, because I do believe what Walt is saying is true, that he's lived his life in fear up to the point where faced with his own mortality, right? And then he realized he had nothing really to fear anymore. I mean, isn't that like the greatest fear that most of us have, is this idea of death? But for Walt, it's he knows he's going to die, and he seems to have come to peace with that. I don't think he really feels his own mortality as a threat. Instead, he's threatened by other things like being irrelevant or not being respected, and that ego being challenged and things like that. So that's what's going to be like what motivates him going forward. But you know, with Hank, we see the complete opposite. This is a character, when faced with his own mortality, reacts the way most healthy, normal people would react, right? Mm-hmm. Where like, you know, you develop some serious like existential crisis over that. And we see that in the form of PTSD with Hank. But I also really love the acting in that scene, and how when Walt says to him at the end of that, you know, so you go out there and you kick it in its teeth. And then the way that Hank sits up and he puts his, you know, chest up and his shoulders back. And then we actually see him go out into the world. And it's something that I think is really, really interesting in terms of how Walt is able to motivate Hank, because we're going to see this again and again and again throughout the series, and how actually instrumental Walt is in motivating Hank to ultimately catch him, right? So there are several occasions, like when he suggests that it couldn't have been Gail Bettiker who was the real mastermind behind Best Friend. Hubris. He could not be, because then that's ego, right? Yeah. And then later, of course, when there are a couple other occasions where this happens, but it's like Walt wants to be caught, maybe like subconsciously in a way. So I mentioned earlier that I think Jimmy, as in Saul McGill, maybe wanted to get caught, and maybe Hank, Walt does in a way too. I don't know. Some interesting stuff going on between them, though, for sure.
I had that same thing in my notes, that, you know, how the way that Hank drops his shoulders and sort of looks relaxed after, you know, he gives him that thing. I thought that was one of the big examples I was talking about when I was saying that I thought he did a great job in that scene. Just really quickly, I think, jump ahead a little bit to whenever he does go into the office, mm-hmm. the way he kind of puts on the mask and. You kind of, I really like the way they do that. Like when he's alone, like he's in the elevator, he looks like he's going to have a meltdown. And then as soon as he gets in front of the group, hey, everybody, you know, like,
I'm home.
Like the performance seems to help him keep it together on some level. But, other than that, I mean, the idea of him being able to only, you know, like that, I think that's pretty humanizing. You know what I mean? Like we all kind of have to do that, right? We all have to wear masks. We all have to do different things, you know, to sort of get through the things that we have to do or whatever. The stakes are a little bit higher here, you know. It makes, like, when you think about him, you know, kind of putting on this whole facade, you know, it makes that idea that he says earlier, like, oh no, not going to go talk to a shrink. You know, you do that,
kiss
and your career
bye,
goodbye, you know? And it's like, you know, that's a pretty real thing for people too. You know what I mean? And not just in his profession, but in a lot of different things. Right. You know what I mean? Like the getting ahead often means that you have to kind of put the thing that you're trying to do ahead of yourself, right? So it's I think that this is all moving in a really good way for Hank to just become a more compelling character.
Oh, I agreed completely. And again, that really stark contrast between him not just in the elevator going up to the offices, and then how he's behaving, you know, with Gomi and the rest of them. But how vulnerable, just to go back to that scene with him and Walt, how vulnerable he is there in front of him. And of course, he doesn't really have a choice in that. Marie lets Walt in and everything. Yeah. And at first he's like, oh, he tries to say it's like, you know, an upset stomach, and he's trying to play it off and everything. But he allows himself to be vulnerable as much as he possibly can in front of Walt. And this is someone, I think, who he has generally considered to be like weak and has not really had a lot of respect for, and is not someone that he thinks of as manly. So I think it's interesting how he's able to to let Walt in as much as he does, to the extent that he does in that episode. I think what happens between them is interesting to skip ahead a little bit, when they do the fake meet between Jimmy In-N-Out and Badger, and how Walt is trying to distract Hank. How does Hank not put two and two together at that point? Yeah. So like I've been thinking a lot about how is Hank thinking of Walt at this point in time? Because he's still not making the really obvious connections. Like at this point, like it should have been kind of obvious. Like what are the odds that his own brother-in-law would show up there? And of course, when they're setting it up and Badger is describing Heisenberg as like a 50 or 70 year old bald dude, right? You know?
So I love that too. He's like, I don't know, he's old. He's like 50 or 70, you know. Yeah. Only 20 years difference there. No difference between a 50 year old and a 70 year old.
Yeah.
They said it's a felony amount. I don't really know. I didn't really look any of that up. That makes a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Intent to sell.
I feel like in the real world, even though, like, I don't know, though, he has priors, though, right? Like, that's been established. He said he was doing the sign. The
helicopter with the sign.
He was doing that, because he was on probation. Okay, so, yeah, so there is a real potential for him to be going to prison here. Badger does not, he doesn't seem like a hardened criminal, you know. In the way that some of the other people that we meet in the series are. So I guess I can kind of see that whole thing. The connection here is that he was caught with the blue meth, obviously. That brings Hank and Gomi over to talk to them, because, you know, he was caught by the APD. I just want to make I really like this character who played the cop. I didn't look up his name. I don't know it. He's like one of those character actors that it seems like every time he shows up, it's, you know, he has a memorable performance, you know, kind of for just like a side appearance or whatever. I don't think I've ever seen him where he features like, you know, where he's like a main character in anything, but he's always stood out to me as being pretty solid, pretty interesting character. So yeah, so there's real pressure on him here. So they do need Saul. They need someone like Saul. All of that tracks pretty directly. What do you think about the idea of them deciding to kidnap Saul here? Does that seem like a little bit of a leap?
So there are quite a few leaps in this episode. And so
gracious, I guess.
No. As much as I love this episode, and I do really love this episode, it's not without its flaws. So certainly with like what they've established thus far, like there's obviously a huge tone shift. And that might just be bringing in the character himself, who, as I already kind of described, is sort of clown-like. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of comedy in this one. And Saul is this bigger-than-life cartoon character. But there are a couple of things, right? So the idea that they decide to kidnap him and force him to take a bribe doesn't seem like it's that much of a stretch, although it is interesting, considering where we see that Walt is already headed, like where he wanted Jesse to go and take his gun and handle the spooge problem and everything. But like the biggest leap for me, and I know they played it for laughs and for comedy, but it's when they're actually out in the desert. And Saul is giving them their options. He's like, you know, you could, shank, you know, Badger in the chow line or whatever. And Walt is considering it. And then Jesse's like, no, we're not killing Badger. And then Walt does this like thing with his face, like, oh, you're like, he's so disappointed or whatever. And it's a funny moment, but I'm like, this seems like a caricature of what they've been doing. Yeah. I don't know. So that's like there are a couple of other moments where I'm like,
it does. It feels a little bit different. I think that's. I don't think it really needs to be that much more specific. I think it's a combination of things, you know. And maybe that's not. I think that for me, the first time I watched it, I thought the whole kidnapping thing seemed crazy. But I mean, it's not inconsistent with the characters necessarily. I mean, they do go and steal the methylamine, and they. In those same masks, you know what I mean? They tie the guy up in the port-a-john. So they have shown that they're capable of going into criminal mode, I guess, in ways. But yeah, like this is when I was watching it, like I was, you know, on the rewatch here, I thought about that. I thought like there's some leaps in this one. And sometimes like just like the fact that Jesse is the one that's doing all the talking whenever when they get him out in the desert feels a little bit off too. You know what I mean? It feels like Walt wouldn't let him do that.
Well, Saul knows Walt's voice because remember
true.
He went in
I mean,
there
it makes
as,
sense.
As yeah. So he did. He couldn't really talk since he might be recognized by his voice. But just one other leap. We already talked a little bit about it, but when they do that fake setup with Hank, I thought again that kind of stretches credulity a little bit. Where like Walt is going to go and distract Hank at the exact moment, like they're trying to record this thing, and you know,
take a break, wander around in a fugue state. We'll be right back.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Madman and father of Mad Max, George Miller, is back with another apocalyptic tale from the Australian wastelands.
This time, we're getting a prequel featuring the origin story of Charlize Theron's character Furiosa, starring the Queen's Gambit's Anya Taylor-Joy in the title role and the mighty Thor Chris Hemsworth as the warlord Dr. Dementis. Furiosa promises more high-octane, slightly radioactive action and fun.
Furiosa drives into theaters on May 24th, and we'll have our spoiler-free thoughts and impressions of the film, as well as a discussion of trailers and upcoming movies for everyone. But if you want to ride with us the full length of the podcast on the eternal highways of Valhalla, shiny and chrome, you're going to have to be a club member.
Join today at support.baldmove.com. Get our full discussion of Furiosa and many more first-run films, plus tons of other bonus podcasts and ad-free feeds.
Support.baldmove.com.
Tight, tight, tight. We're back with more GDT.
But again, like it makes sense for the episode. I'm willing to, you know, suspend disbelief a little bit because it works and the comedy is really good in it. This isn't certainly the only time in the series where you're kind of like, would this really happen? Could this really happen?
Well, I think that comes back to the structure again, too, a little bit, because it has to all be wrapped up by the end of the episode. You know, that's what it feels like.
Yeah.
And that's where it starts to feel a little bit more like an episodic TV show where you know they're going to have this they're going to have this problem present itself and then they'll wrap it up and then next week there'll be another problem or something like that, which is not the kind of show that this has been. So yeah, I think that you feel that in the way this plays out. But because everything else is operating on such a high level, there are a ton of great things that happen in that process. You know what I mean? And you know, like we touched on it a little bit, the conversation that Badger has with the cop and how he, you know, his feelings were hurt that his new buddy was actually, you know, not he was really setting him up to go down for a felony. I really like the way that like I said, I know Bob Odenkirk, so just him being on screen was, you know, that's something that you recognize. He was a recognizable guy, you know what I mean? So it was great the way he busted in. He, you know, he takes control of the situation, and you know that he's not going to be completely insignificant, that he's going to be around for a while at least, as a new character. you know, I really liked whenever Hank came in and he says, your commercials, they suck ass or whatever.
They suck. Yeah. Oh, speaking of which, you know, when I've rewatched that scene when Saul is in the hallway, right, talking to Francesca, asking about what happened to his public masturbator, yeah. And he sees Hank and Gomi come in and he stops to talk to him. And he's like, what would two feds want with this little, you know, whatever he calls him, this little turd? And seeing Better Call Saul, we know that this isn't actually the first time that these characters meet because, if you'll recall, the cartel, the Salamancas specifically, send Saul in to defend Crazy Eight, right? And that's how he becomes a snitch, which we see in like the early episodes of season one of Breaking Bad, right? So there's already this relationship, and there's this great scene in Better Call Saul when it's actually the episode they introduce Hank to Better Call Saul. It's his first appearance when he goes in to meet with Crazy Eight, and Saul comes in and sets that up for him. And they make a deal with them. So I was looking to see, like, do you get a sense that there's history between these characters? And I think it actually works, right? Because like Saul recognizes that they're feds, right? And he recognizes that perhaps there is some interest in his client. So I think that was really fortuitous because, of course, they had no way of knowing that these characters would have history when this episode was written, of course, before they got to Better Call Saul. I wanted to backtrack a little bit. I had a question for you. So we were talking a little bit about them going out into the desert. And I was curious what you think their end goal was, meaning Jesse and Walt. Like, what do you think they actually intended to happen? So, like, Saul himself says that, you know, he's keeping a happy thought and the open grave is just a negotiating tactic, right? So tell me what you really want. And then they're just like, you're going to give him the best defense possible ever. Do you think that's all they wanted? They just wanted to force him to defend him and not, you know, get the DEA involved? Like, what were they actually hoping for?
Yeah, I think that they actually were. I think what Walt told him at the office is where he was at. Walt wants to get rid of this problem. He doesn't want the DEA involved in general, you know, generally speaking, just because, you know, but also because of Hank, right? So I think that naively enough, you know, they just wanted to say, look, no matter what, he doesn't talk to the DEA. If you can get him out, great. But I think, you know, Jesse kind of says this in the car when they're outside before they go to meet him. He says, you know, Badger's too loyal. He'll never turn. And he's not, you know, and he's afraid of me. So that all of that's working in their favor. So I think that, yeah, they just sort of think like, hey, you know what? If we can just make sure the DEA, he doesn't talk to the DEA, hopefully this guy can get him off, you know what I mean? But if not, then he goes to prison and that's too bad, you know what I mean? But he did get caught. I think that's probably what they had in mind.
Yeah. I mean, it just works out really well that Saul is who Saul is and is able to come up with this whole other great plan. Yeah.
The
for them.
The whole idea of Jimmy, not Jimmy McGill, but Jimmy Kilkelly, is that what it is? It is a solution, right? I mean, that is like exactly what they needed. I think that this is something that exists in the world. Like, I think that you probably can find characters like this who spent a lot of time in prison and don't mind going back for the right price. If you were of that disposition of where you preferred it inside, if you had the $30,000 on top, you know, you would be living pretty well in there, comparatively speaking. As far as what they're doing, you mentioned it in passing and in the way that was kind of a weird reaction, but like, I think it's important to note that Walt was thinking about killing Badger, like that was something that made a lot of sense to him logically or strategically. Yeah. When you think about the two characters, Walt has killed someone already. Jesse hasn't, but you know, he did his best to kill Tuco, even though he didn't, you know, do that or whatever. But you know, so we see there that the way that they're reacting to that differently, you know, like Jesse is Badger's his friend, right? And there is some loyalty among them, whereas Walt is he has none, right? He's all business as far as that's concerned.
Yeah, he calls him Beaver later. I mean, that's how how much Badger
means
to Walt.
Purpose,
how much
though,
he
just
ate him.
To let him.
I laugh every time. From Beaver or whatever. Oh, it's so good. It's so good. But I don't actually, the reason I was asking, because I didn't get the impression that Walt's, that was something that was on his radar before Saul suggested it. It's like Saul presents the idea and he's like, wait a minute, you know, that's a pretty good idea. And
I would agree.
There's so many good lines, so many good lines in this one. One of my favorite lines, it's not my top pick, but one of my favorites is when Saul says to them, you know, a mosquito's buzzing around. You don't go after the mosquito's attorney. You grab a fly swatter, guys. And it seems to me like that's where Saul really, I think, sells some of his value to Walt. And he does it again later when he goes and sees him in the classroom. And he's really trying to persuade him, like, this is why you need me. This is why you need representation. But the resources that he has, and also like his ability to think the way he thinks, is something that's incredibly valuable to Walt, since they are so naive and they are so bad at this. And so having someone like him in their corner is a match made in meth heaven.
Yeah, because it's funny because of all of the interest on it wasn't me, or you know, it was Ignacio, it wasn't me, or it, you know, like the whole it was Lalo, or you're not Lalo didn't send you. Yeah, that's what it was, right? Like, no Lalo, Lalo didn't send you. Like, all of that was always such a big part of what was going on in BCS and like what we thought about, that you kind of miss out on what's really important about this scene. And it's exactly what you were just saying. It's that it's a stupid idea. Like, it's not well thought out at all. Like, threaten to kill the lawyer of the guy. You know what I mean? Like, Saul points it out and they can't help but recognize that he's correct there, right? Like, it's a stupid idea. Like, you're threatening this guy who has nothing to do with it in a way, right? And you have the person that you could take out right there. You know what I mean? Like, if you really wanted to stop him from talking, like if you kill Saul, he can still talk. If you kill Badger, he can't talk anymore, right? And I agree with what you said too. I don't think Walt had that in mind before, but whenever he was presented with that idea, he realized that that makes a lot more sense, right? And he looked at it more as a just a cold calculation of like, that would be better for this organization that we put together. Like I said, by the end of the episode, you realize that he's a funny guy and he's kind of a clown, but he actually does know quite a bit more about what these guys are doing than they do.
Definitely. And since we're talking about this scene in the desert, I did want to talk a little bit about like how that scene is expanded specifically in the Better Call Saul episode 611. So we get to see that episode begins with him being kidnapped, right? So their cold open to that one is with from Saul's point of view, he's got the burlap sack over his head rolling around in the back of the RV on the way to the desert. And then they return to that scene, the exact same scene. They even repeat the same dialogue where they have him kneeling in front of the hole in the ground. No, it wasn't me. It was Ignacio. No, Lalo didn't send you. And then, but we get to see them go back into the RV leaving. And, Saul is looking around the RV. He's picking up like the boiling flask and stuff like that. And he's figuring out exactly what they're about. And, he's able to see the potential there, the opportunity to make a lot of money with these two. So, obviously, he knows a little something about Heisenberg, not just from Badger, but maybe also from like other clients, right? So even in this episode, right, he mentions Spooge and Spooge being a former client of his, right? When he makes the comment that people like to take credit for all the fun ones, right? So Walt already has something of a reputation out on the streets at this point, right? in this Breaking Bad timeline anyway, and Saul's, I guess, seeing the dollar signs there. So I really like how they added a lot of context to, like, why Saul would agree to do this, right? So it's beyond just, like, seeing opportunity for money. He sees Walt as moldable clay, right?
Like, he sees the incompetence and realizes that thing that we're just talking about, that he could actually turn that into something. That they could use that to his advantage. Where Mike is like, stay away from this guy. He's a complete amateur. Jimmy sees a totally different opportunity there.
Yeah, and Mike says the same thing to Gus as well, right? Like, he tries to warn everyone, stay away.
Yeah, Mike, he got it right when it came to Walter, and makes it all the more tragic that Walter's the one that ends him, huh?
Mm-hmm. Especially when he didn't have to.
Yeah, it's completely
necessary.
Completely pointless. Just because he hurt his feelings.
And and just one other point, I guess, about the Better Call Saul Breaking Bad episode. I love how they ended that one, right? So, like, because if you haven't seen it, like, we get to see where Saul ends up in the future as Gene, and this is his Breaking Bad moment, Gene in the future. And they the way they splice that together of him at the very end of that episode walking into the classroom, right? So, like, we see Saul actually, and then we see it in this episode of Breaking Bad when he at the end goes to see Walt in the classroom. But we get to also see it from the Better Call Saul perspective of him walking up to the classroom, walking up to the building anyway. And then they put that together with him going back into this Mark's house that he's going to break into as Gene. And, like, crossing thresholds, crossing barriers, opening doors that really shouldn't be opened, one bad decision after another.
I think whenever, when I watched that episode of Better Call Saul for the first time, it was one of those ones where it took some time to process, what are they really trying to emphasize here? And we were talking about this a little bit before we started recording about, it's pretty clear what they're showing in that episode when you go back and watch it now, knowing how that series ended. At the time, it wasn't all that clear at all, we didn't really know what's going on because it's really the first time we're spending time, like a lot of time with Gene, right? And we get to see, how quickly things go from bad to worse in that situation. And, like, the way, the stuff that they tied back into this episode, into 208 of Breaking Bad, it's very particular. And they wanted to, you could see that they wanted to kind of fill in some blanks, right? And,
Yeah, and it's beyond just having, like, Brian and Aaron do cameos on Better Call Saul because it was, like, the last couple of episodes before the series ended. I think it really does add a lot. And my favorite shot in that episode of that Better Call Saul episode is a shot that we see in this one, but they added to it, of course. And that's when they're out in the desert, you see the grave dug. And the way they transition between scenes in the Better Call Saul episode is they film, the camera looks down into the grave out in the desert, and then that fades into Gene lying in bed, right? So it looks like he's lying in this grave. And I think the context there, the subtext that we're being told is that this was the moment that he doomed himself, right? Like, he, is lying in his grave, sort of thing. So it was this relationship with Walt that he enters into that, really seals his fate. Yeah. Although with Better Call Saul, there's a lot of stuff that happens before he ever even meets.
Watching these two together definitely expanded both of them for me, like my understanding of the character of Walter White and the character of Jimmy McGill / Saul Goodman. And that's a pretty neat trick that you to be able to do that. And I'm glad that they took that opportunity, I think you brought it up a little bit earlier, the way that they introduced Tuco. They got a lot of for that. I mean, they got a lot of people were complaining like, oh, this is, it feels like it's a cheap way to, connect the series or whatever to keep bringing back characters for cameos. And I think they kind of pulled back from a little bit from there in the early seasons of Breaking Bad, but I mean in Better Call Saul, but they, you know, they were definitely always planning on getting to the point where we see Walter White and Jesse Pinkman show up. I mean that they may have played coy about it, but I think that they were always, every season when they sat down to you know, chart it out or whatever, you know, break the episodes, they probably mm-hmm. thought, can we fit a Walt and a Jesse in here somewhere? Like, where are we at on the timeline? Maybe a flash forward, you know? They're just, the two characters influence each other so much that you can't really have a show about one without the other, at least a little bit.
Yeah. I'm really glad that they held back, though, until the very end, because I feel like, you know, there was a part of the viewership that was tuning in just out of curiosity, like, well, I like Breaking Bad, let's see what this is about. And they were expecting very much the same thing, like a continuation of that story, same style, same characters and stuff like that. And it being a spinoff, like, of course, you expect that to some degree. But I think the most interesting parts of that series actually have nothing to do with really Walt or any of these other like characters. Apart from, I mean, there is obviously characters that overlap. So Mike is a main character on Better Call Saul, and he's an important part of that show. Of course, Gus then becomes a very important part of that show, too. But those are not cameos. Those are supporting cast, right? And I'm glad that they didn't mm-hmm. do too much fan service. For want of a better word. And I think the for me personally, the most interesting parts of Saul are the new characters we get to meet, that relationship with his brother, that relationship with Kim.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think they did that in the most tasteful way they could. Was they made it matter. They made that those decisions that he made in relation to what's happening here. They gave them some substance. They made it, you know, fleshed it out a little bit more, like what he was thinking about. And it all makes sense for everything else that happened in Jimmy McGill's life to get him to that point. And that's where, you know, that's where it feels satisfying. It's not that because Walt is there or, you know, Jesse's there, or, you know, that shows up or whatever. That just happens to be that, you know, that just happens to line up. Or whatever, you know, so it feels natural. Mm-hmm. As far as being out in the desert, I think we covered everything. I mean, do we need to point out the idea that, like, I mean, there's a lot of things here that they came back mm-hmm. to whenever they were constructing the story of Better Call
right,
Saul.
Yeah.
I
so
guess,
it foreshadows
right?
quite a few characters, of course. We already mentioned it, but Ignacio, Nacho, and then Lalo, this is probably something most people know, like if you are into Better Call Saul and, you know, follow what the creators have said. But it was something that Vince Gilligan was actually quite against them doing. He's like, we don't need to write about old Lalo. Who cares? Whatever. It was just like a one-off mm-hmm. line. But, you know, they were like, Peter Gould was like, no, we have to bring them. I'm glad Peter won that argument. I am. And speaking of Peter and Vince, something I didn't know but learned from listening to the Insider podcast was how they came up with the name. It was actually Vince's idea to call him Saul Good, like it's all good. And then someone else in the writer's room was like, why don't we call him Good Men, though? So I thought that was pretty interesting. Because I know this is Peter Gould's creation. This was a character he conceived of, I believe, right? Like, he actually came up with the idea of Saul.
Yeah, and he wrote this episode, too, mm-hmm. Which is nice. The whole idea of turning him into Goodman, they kind of have a line to that effect here. You know, the Jew thing I just do for the homeboys.
The real name's McGill.
They say they want a pipe-hitting member of the tribe, so to speak, which is a pretty Saul Goodman line.
Oh, we've already talked a lot about a few of them, right? So there's also Spooge, right? That's something we see again in Saul. His relationship with Francesca is something that really gets expanded and explored in Saul. And one of the things that always bothered me watching Better Call Saul, and I think this is something that they did address, though, was just like trying to reconcile, like, how could Jimmy McGill, like our Jimmy, be the same guy that like whistles after Francesca and you know, tells her that she's killing him with that booty? I was like, ugh, like, how are they going to do that? How are they going to do that? But then rewatching 611 of Better Call Saul, you see that when Kim comes in to sign the divorce papers as she's leaving, he refers to Francesca as sweet cheeks, right? And it's like this, like, that's just all part of the act of the, I don't give a shit about anything. You can't hurt me, Kim. I'm Teflon sort of attitude that he, posture that he takes, right? So, poor Francesca.
Yeah, I think, one of the things about watching 6-11 too, it's a really good ending for Francesca, the way that they put that together.
Yeah.
I love how he's still talking and she just hangs up the phone. It's a great one.
I hope
exit.
Sorry, I was going to say, I hope with that money she got in the envelope that she's finally able to go on her vacation to one of the various places that she's always looking at in her magazines. You know, instead of plunging seeds and stems out of some pothead's, sink.
One thing I wanted to ask you, one thing that popped out whenever I was watching this time, whenever Walt goes in to talk to Saul, he says, what are you telling him? You know, because he says, no, what about the reprisal? You know, he tells him that he's afraid that this Heisenberg is going to come after them, right? If he talks to the DEA. And he says, Saul makes it clear that at that moment, Badger is not cooperating. Like he won't talk to the cops. Like he's basically saying, I can talk him into it, but right now he won't do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so then he offers him the bribe, and then he goes out to the car and tells Jesse, well, no, he won't take it. But then Jesse says Badger is going to spill as a question, right? He asks him, and he says, like Valdez or whatever he says, right? Like the Valdez. Do you think that is a actual, is he misleading him there?
Is Saul misleading
No.
Walt, is, or is Walt lying to Jesse?
Is Walt trying to mislead Jesse? Yeah.
That's a good question. I don't.
Yeah, because I mean, the truth of the matter is that he's going to try to talk him into it, but there's still a chance that what Jesse said earlier was true, that he's too loyal. It's not going to happen.
Okay, well, let's pause there for a second. Why is he loyal? Obviously, he's Jesse's friend and everything, but he's scared of Jesse. Right now, he thinks that Jesse actually killed Spooge, but of course, Saul has knowledge that he didn't. And Saul, I think, would be trying to convince Badger, like, this is in your best interest. You want to take this deal. Obviously, that's in Saul's best interest. He wants to win this case and do right by his client.
I didn't think about that. I didn't think about the fact that he would tell him the exact same thing he told Walt. He's going to say, like, you don't understand, this guy is dangerous.
Yeah,
he killed Spooge, and he's going to say, no, he did not. His wife did. And I know that for a fact. So that does have some, that does play a part, I guess, in his ability to flip him. But yeah, I never really picked up on that before. I thought the line stands out, like, he's going to spill like the Valdez. I mean, obviously, that's a memorable line that they say. But I was just wondering, like, I wonder if he comes out thinking, okay, well, I've offered the bribe, so now I have to, because I'm trying to make the whole let's go kidnap this guy and everything else, like, make sense, right? So Walt, I guess they don't really show it, but I guess if we put it together there, it does kind of add up, huh? Like that he might just be like, I really need to find a solution to this. Like, this guy is he didn't just turn me down, but this guy himself is sort of a loose end in that we can get to him. We can't get to Badger that easily while he's locked up or whatever.
Yeah. And I think in the broader context of the story of Breaking Bad, right, loyalty comes at a price. So we certainly see that with, like, Gus's 11 guys in prison. Like, they're willing to stay quiet as long as, their payments are being made to their families, that that lawyer is facilitating, Daniel, whatever his name was. But with the Badger, I think he would have been persuaded to absolutely flip if he wasn't really in fear of his life or reprisal. That Jesse would kill him him or something.
Yeah, I mean, Badger seems like a pretty harmless guy and everything else, but you're probably right. Like, put up against, like, a 5-year stay in the penitentiary or something like that.
I mean, they're friends and everything, but Jesse also did abandon him in the desert, right?
That's true.
So, I mean, they're...
The crossbow incident.
Javelinas, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I like that they give him a little bit more to do here. Badger always is kind of the biggest ass in the room whenever they're all together, and kind of the silliest character. So it translated well to all the stuff that he gets to do in this episode.
And it would make sense that he would be the one that got busted, doesn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it kind of, when you think about the big picture, it kind of like they all Skinny Pete gets stuck up. Badger gets busted, and then Combo gets the worst out of all of them. You know,
yeah.
All of it, of course, is related to these ideas that Walt had, that they needed to expand exponentially. That's what I thought about whenever the money counting, you know, they had that scene with the money counting machine, and he says something to the effect of like, we need to have this thing running 24 hours. You know, we're going to feed this machine or whatever. We need to have this running 24/7. It's like, you had it. Just a couple of weeks ago, you had it the perfect amount. You know what I mean? The money was coming in at a steady pace, not too much heat, not too much problems. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And as that machine's counting, as it's going, you know what I mean? Like, the problems are just getting bigger and coming more frequently now.
Yeah. Yeah. And since you're talking about the money counter, just another point, because like watching it again and watching it closely, they do keep track of the money coming in and coming out if you're paying attention, right? So I have this in my notes here that it was almost $90,000 that they made, that they're divvying up. And then later we know that it's going to cost them $80,000, right, for Saul's
almost
cut.
Back to zero.
Yeah, so yeah. they have $10,000 for their trouble. I thought that was an interesting little detail and how conscience becomes expensive. And perhaps too expensive for Walt.
That's what he says, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Growth, Decay, Transformation. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what two-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
Let's get cooking. We're back with more Growth, Decay, Transformation.
So, was there anything else in the main? I mean, one thing about the other thing about the character, like we were talking about, just to loop back for 1 second, talking about how there was a lot of stuff that they picked up on later, like Lalo and Nacho and, you know, the Bluetooth we talked about in previous episodes, you know, how whenever he first comes on, we kind of associate him with the same kind of guy that Ken Wins is in a way, you know what I mean? The kind of loud and his words are definitely like his secret weapon kind of thing. He mentions Ice Station and Zebra Associates here, which will take on a lot of meaning later on. But just from the get-go, you know, you think, well, that's really sounds kind of specific. So if you didn't know what the movie was, you know, if you go and look it up, you'll find out that that's a movie. So you think, okay, this guy likes movies, right? He's a movie guy.
And that was actually Kim's dad's favorite movie, Ice Station Zebra.
And then, of course, the TV commercials, which we'll see how he, you know, how he has a passion for his, for shooting those later on.
All the commercials he makes, not just for his law practice, but when he first conceives of the persona of Saul Goodman as the guy who sells TV commercials. So good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something that did pop out to me that I have in my notes here, because I think this is something that I thought a lot about when I watched the Better Call Saul episode. And I feel like this one line that Walt says informs a lot of how like I understood that particular episode. They're sitting, Jesse and Walt are sitting in the car. They're watching this deal go down between Badger and Jimmy In-N-Out. And Jesse says something like, you think this guy's for real? A guy that like wants to go to prison? And Walt says, there's more than one kind of prison. And that's a line that always jumped out to me. And Jesse's like, what? Like, what does that mean? But the idea that for Kilkelly, the real world is more horrible to him than being institutionalized. That's where he's more comfortable, sort of thing. And but I think it's a curious line from Walt, and like maybe how he thinks of like his own oppression or the forces that are acting upon him. But then how that informs the Better Call Saul episode, just to shift gears a little bit here. And why Gene decides to break bad, right? Like living as Gene, this like really boring humdrum life as like, you know, a manager of a Omaha Cinnabon, you know, like that's more of a prison to him than actual prison. And that turns out to actually be true if you continue watching that series. So I don't know. I just thought that was an interesting line into maybe giving us some insight into how Walt is thinking about himself and the idea of freedom and being trapped or imprisoned.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to what he was saying to Hank earlier, right?
Yeah, fear.
Mm-hmm.
Fear
that
as
idea
the
of fear
as the ultimate prisoner, and he's broken free of those shackles, maybe.
Don't worry, though. Things will go wrong and soon. Everything will eventually fall apart so that any kind of freedom that he seems to be experiencing will be short-lived. Anytime he gets a stack of cash and everything starts to look like his financial troubles are over,
something else happens, yeah.
Another expenditure will pop up.
Exactly.
Want to get into favorite lines and shots?
Yeah, I think so. I think we've pretty much covered everything.
For my favorite line, I went with one of the first ones that Saul says, and it's when he comes in and he's talking to the cop, and he says, go grab a juice box, have a nap, go on. And I thought that's a great first couple of lines kind of thing for a character to say, isn't it?
It is. So many great lines from Saul. And I had a hard time choosing this one, but I thought I was going to have to go with the Saul line just because it's Saul, but I didn't go with Saul. I went with Jesse talking to Walta, and the line is, you don't want a criminal lawyer. You want a criminal lawyer. So,
yeah, I'm glad you did, because, you know, that's so often repeated, and it's just such a big part of this universe that it's almost like you forget about it. You know what I mean? It's like, but it is. That's one of the best. I mean, talk about introducing a brand new character who will go on to be a big multi-season backstory series about. You know what I mean? Like, what a great way to introduce him.
Yeah, great line. And it's one of the most quotable lines, I think, from from the series, and it's been getting a lot of play currently in what is today's date? Today is the 10th of June 2023. It's something that they've been playing in the news quite a bit for unrelated reasons, but again, it's just like one of those great lines. And as you said, Pete, before we even meet him, right, like that's how we're introduced to him, this criminal defense attorney who himself is a criminal. So
Houdini.
Yeah.
Which I don't even really know. That's not the best way to... Houdini gets out of stuff, not other people, right? Like Houdini, what the famous magician Houdini was not known for getting other people out of jams. He got himself... He was an escape artist, right?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I'm not
so
familiar.
It wasn't like a... Yeah. It's one of those funny... I just thought that was like one of those funny Jesse things where he's like... He's close to like what he's saying, but it's not exactly the best example.
But the idea of being able to work magic, the guy's a magician, right?
And yeah, that's true.
That's something that Saul says in the Better Call Saul episode of Breaking Bad, where he says, you know, I'm going to work my magic here. So this idea that he's a magician of some sorts that's able to make things happen. And he does, right? He is kind of the magic man, isn't he? It's the name of an episode in Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
I had a couple of runner-ups for this, though, because like so many great lines. So I love the one when Badger asks him, you're going to get me off, right? And he says, what do I look like, your high school girlfriend? Five fingers, no waiting. Or when he meets Walt and he asks if Mayhew is British or Irish, and Walt says Irish, and he goes, ah, fellow potato eater. Oh, so great. So many great lines. So good. What about
with a character like that, you know, there's always a they always have to strike a balance. And it's one of the things that, because like, you know, like people don't really talk like that. I mean, they almost do, you know what I mean? But like, you have to be careful, I think, where if he says something, if he always has the perfect quip, if he always has the, you know, the funniest line, then he starts to feel like a character. I can't say
caricature,
the word.
Yeah,
caricature.
But he kind of is, right? And I think that's something that Better Call Saul as a series explains to us, that this
well,
is
that's what I was gonna say.
Just a caricature.
You know, like that, yeah, like that it is. It's an act, you know? But we don't know that when we first meet him way back then, right? And yeah. And I think that that's a reason why that you know, when you think about the original idea was that maybe do a 30-minute comedy with Better Call Saul for that series. I think that that was probably a really good choice for them not to do that, because they're not comedy writers. They write drama, right? You know what I mean? Like, they're really good at spicing it up with some laughs here and there, but it's a whole different beast when you think about it.
Yeah,
so.
I would call both series dramedies, right? There's a lot of dark humor in both.
Yeah, but I think there's a big difference between anything that is set up as a... I mean, comedies are joke delivery devices, you know what I mean? They're supposed to make you laugh. They're not... Everything else is, you know... Like, when you say dramedy, it's not like 50-50, you know what I mean? It's a drama that has a lot of funny, you know, has a lot of comedy in it. But, you know, it's a two different beast, I think.
Yeah,
but
we do get the idea, just to go back to what you said about like this idea of Saul as a caricature. We do get to see a little bit behind the mask, right? When he tells Walt that, you know, Saul Goodman isn't his real name; it's just something that he does for the homeboys, the whole Jew thing. So you get the idea that this is not who this guy really is. It is all an act. It is a performance. So I love how they explore all that in Saul, though, and add so much depth to that character. Is it hard for you to think of him as Saul Goodman? Do you think of him as Jimmy McGill as you're watching this, or do you think of him as Saul?
No, that's one of the things that I was going to bring up earlier and I forgot, so I'm glad you hit on it. But When we watch this in sequence, you know, we watch Breaking Bad, it, you know, up by itself, I think I went right back into Saul. Like, at the end of Better Call Saul, I thought of him as Jimmy. Like, I almost never referred to him as Saul anymore or anything else. But when I watched this, and when I was preparing my notes for this and stuff, it was all Saul. You know, like, I went right back into the mode that I was before. So that's interesting. It's not like I forgot, you know, obviously I still am fascinated with the character of Jimmy McGill and everything that he goes through to get to this point. But just because of the way that this show, you know, watching the show in order, we're talking about Walt and Jesse. We're not talking about Jimmy McGill, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And in that, from their perspective, he's Saul, right? Mm-hmm. And so it kind of feels that way too. I think as it goes on though, we'll start to, like I said, it does feel definitely more like you brought up in the beginning, that it's definitely feels sadder, you know, the whole situation. It's not nearly as funny as it was maybe the first time around, you know?
Yeah. I mentioned earlier, like it is easier for me to separate the two. And I think a lot of that is because Better Call Saul is about Jimmy McGill. And we don't really get to spend a lot of time with this character of Saul. Like, we get to see how he ends up there. We have a couple of scenes with him. But the vast majority of it is Jimmy McGill. And really, we get more time with Gene than we do with Saul in that series. But it is, I still think of him as Jimmy. So, I mean, this I think of him as two different characters. But I do, like, when they were talking about Jimmy Kilkelly, I was like, when Walt and Jesse are like, where's Jimmy? Yeah. I was thinking of Saul. I'm like, no, that's not who they're talking about. And it was a weird moment, right? Because I was like, wait, no. I knew that they were talking about Jimmy In-N-Out, James Kilkelly, but for a split second, I was like, Saul, I don't remember that, but, you know, just one of those things. And yeah, I guess I think of like that scene at the end of Fun and Games 609, Better Call Saul, where is it Fun and Yeah, it is Fun and it's yeah. definitely Fun and Games when they're at Howard's memorial service at HHM, and they're talking to Rich Schweikart, and as he's saying goodbye to them, as Rich is saying goodbye to Jimmy and Kim, he goes and calls Jimmy. Jimmy, he's like, sorry, Saul. That's kind of like how I how I feel. It's like, Jimmy, no, Saul. So it is interesting because I'm so saturated with Saul, I think, still. So I imagine as we go further into this, in this rewatch, like, I won't be thinking of him as much as Jimmy as I am right now. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, I remember that at the end, you know, people were being like, oh, you know, now that I saw him do this, he's back to Saul. And he just never really went back to Saul for me until I watched this episode the other day. And then I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. This is Saul Goodman. This is, you know, we don't know all the rest about him yet, but we will.
So, yeah, I was going to ask, what favorite shot, favorite scene for you?
I really like the bench, you know, the oneer and the teaser that we were talking about. And we didn't bring it up a lot, but I did listen to the Insider podcast and they talked about how they shot this all as a one take scene, you know, like there's no interruptions, but they had to shorten it. And it's pretty interesting. I went back and watched it after I listened to it, and you can kind of see where they did that. Because like they'll do it like where a car or a person walks in front of them in front of the camera, so that it sort of blocks out what they're doing. So like whenever the person clears the shot, then they can just skip ahead to a different part of it if they wanted to, if they do it just right, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously Badger and the cop are moving around a lot, so they have to be pretty selective in how they did it. But since this is the Saul episode, you know, it's all about Saul. I decided to go with the shot of him. He's when he's leaving the office and Walt says $10,000. It's not like the flashiest thing, but there's a lot going on, and you got to kind of put yourself in the idea that we don't really know this guy yet. You know what I mean? So the timing of the way that he turns, like we're not really sure what's happening with him. Right. The door opens up. You hear that obnoxious music that plays in his lobby there, the way that is. And the door like is timed perfectly so that it opens and you just see Walt as he's saying $10,000. So the setup of it, all of it, is really great. And then, you know, Bob Odenkirk's face whenever he hears that, you know, $10,000. Like, we don't know the character that much yet, but we can see pretty, and we've got the idea that he does like money, you know what I mean? Like, this is a thing that motivates him, and that 10,000 really, you know, perked his ears up or whatever, and he closed it. So yeah, I thought that was really a nice little sequence, the way they set all of that up. That music in the lobby really kind of puts it over the top. And we didn't even really talk about it, but his office, like the way that they designed his office with that, the whole thing, like, you know, you kind of take it for granted all this time later.
Mm-hmm.
But that was like that in the, when you first saw it, you were like, holy shit, this guy's got fake columns and the giant constitution behind him and everything else. You know what I mean? Like, what an introduction to that office that was.
And then, of course, the blow-up Statue of Liberty on
yeah,
his roof.
Like all of that.
Yeah.
Like, I think we didn't really mention it much kind of because it just became so normal over all the seasons. But
yeah. And, of course, those are things that are explained in Better Call Saul, where he gets at least the idea for it from. So certainly, like, the decor he steals from the Kettlemans and their little – mm-hmm. Tax thing that they're doing. They have the same blow up. They're playing similar music in their mm-hmm. waiting room, and they have like the American flag on their walls, you know? So again, yeah. Like this appeal to like people's values and beliefs, which we talked a little bit at the top of this, right? So this idea of the Constitution and selling this ideal, I think. Yeah. Yeah. There's some
so
great.
What about you? What was your favorite shot?
So I had to go with in the desert. There's a lot of interesting things that happen there, but we get two separate overhead shots of the RV, and I went with the second one. I really like the way the lighting is.
Mm-hmm.
They have the saturation way up on the colors so that the headlights are casting like a really kind of eerie green glow over them, and you can see the three figures. This is after he's already been lit up. He's not on his knees, but you can still see the grave right in front of him. And then you get this like reddish pink color in the background, and you have like the last remnants of daylight, right? So it's the sky is this really beautiful blue color. But I was thinking of like the green, you know, is associated with money in this world, right? A potential for growth. And I just love that shot and the colors more than anything in that one.
Yeah,
I've cut that
clip so many times.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, like all those videos of what is the Lalo? No Lalo. Why does he bring up Lalo? Like he should know. And all this, you know, all those different videos talking about stuff. Like I'll always go back to that cut of the overhead shot. It's a fantastic looking. Thing that just elicits that whole situation, you know what I mean? Like in, you know, there's so much in that one image. It's a great one.
Yeah. Was there anything else that stood out to you watching the Better Call Saul episode after this?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think the whole idea of him going to, you know, talking to Mike, I love that they had Mike wear the glasses.
Yeah.
The sunglasses in that scene, because we haven't seen Mike's introduction to Breaking Bad yet, but that's one of my favorite parts is how they're like, oh yeah, put some glasses on him. He's cool. You know what I mean? He's a fixer. Make him look like a fixer. He wore dark glasses or something. And then he just never does that again throughout the rest of the series, except for here, whenever they make that like specific visual callback to it. I just thought, but as far as that, like the gene timeline stuff, it was just sad, you know what I mean? It was just like, okay, I know why he's doing this now. I know how all of what he's going to go through in Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, both series is leading up to that point. And I like the parallel, I like the parallel there of like, okay, well, this is him. This is his first, you know, he's still reeling over Kim leaving. And now this is his first, like, you know, big mistake, which is to like, yeah, I know everybody's saying I should stay away from this guy, but I think I could probably make this work to my advantage. And then we see how that plays out.
And of course, we have the benefit of knowing that, you know, maybe he's not like rolling in money, but it was a pretty good payout that he received from the Sandpiper settlement. So it's not that he necessarily even needs the money from Walt. So he's attracted to something more than that. And then, of course, in Better Call Saul, like we see that what really perhaps motivates him to work with Walt is, wanting to be a part of something big, like a way to do schemes and cons and things like that. more than the money. Of course, the money is important, though.
Yeah, I listened to the Insider podcast on that one, too.
Oh, did you?
Tom Schnauz was saying, you know, about Walt and about Jimmy, you know, like the way that they go to their things. And like Jimmy, that's his drug of choice, right? It's the scam.
Yeah.
And the progression, I guess, is that it's got to be bigger. It's got to be, you know, like once you're doing the same one over and over again, it loses the charm, right? So you want to go up to the next level. And I think, yeah, like you said, I think Saul Goodman's doing pretty good where he's at right there, you know? Like, even though we don't know, you know, we're watching Breaking Bad for the first time, you could tell that he's busy. You know, he's got his lobby's packed. He's thrown around numbers like $4,600 and $80,000, and they seem normal. It seemed like the kind of thing that he does on a regular basis for you know, being a criminal lawyer or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the whole thing is just like, it's just like there's a big, him and Heisenberg got a lot in common, right?
Yeah, they do. Definitely. And that's something I think that's, but there are some important differences between them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think that's something in the finale of Saul, where they have like the three flashbacks that he has to Walt, to his brother Charles, and to Mike, and thinking about regrets and how he's capable of learning, right, and changing and growing, and that's something Walt could never do. But I guess that's like a whole other question, maybe like a whole other conversation to have is who is this guy really? Who really is Jimmy McGill, Saul Goodman? Has he always been this way as Walt accuses him of in the finale of Better Call Saul? He says, so you've always been like this? When Jimmy tells the story of how he got the name Slipping Jimmy and, you know, hurt his knee. I love how they also they go back and explain the bad knees that we first hear in this episode when he talks about having bad knees and he has to get up. And that's something they tell us he injured himself when he was like 19, I think was the age mm-hmm. when he did his first major slip and fall or whatever.
Yeah, I wish that we could get more into that. Like I think that we probably will when we get way at the end of Breaking Bad, right? When we get to where that would fit into the timeline of this, you know, like whenever they have that conversation in the
vacuum
and he
store.
Disappears.
Yeah.
Basement there. Because I think one of the things that's fun about going back through this series is to see where we land on all those questions at the end after watching it again. With all that stuff in mind. And yeah, that does, I think, that scene that you just mentioned, it does emphasize a big difference in the two characters, but that is probably a conversation for a different time.
Yeah, definitely.
If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to follow our podcast and, you know, hit that bell so that you get some notifications for it when the next episode comes out. We'd really appreciate it if you would rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts so that other people can find out about us. And if you want to support us, you can join our other patrons on Patreon at patreon.com/growthdecaytransformation.
Yeah, and you can connect with us on Twitter at BreakingBadGDT and write to us at BreakingBadGDT@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Join us next week when we will be discussing 4 Days Out 209.
Better Call Saul.